1, 2, 3, 4. Winter Republic, Chapter 3, EIB. Simferopol the next day is muffled in slow foldings of cloud. A faint gray winter light diffuses through the city, revealing here the gold cupolas of an Orthodox church, there a Cyrillic sign advertising Novia Producti, or a street lamp bronzed with age. Soviet and pre-Soviet era architecture peeks through the mist like the sickbed dream of a dying emperor. Cars and military trucks, a lot of military trucks, pass Thomas as he walks along the sidewalk, their headlights still lit at 9:30 in the morning. The temperature is 5 below freezing. His boots crunch billions of tiny ice crystals deposited on the concrete from the fog. A left on Prospect Kirova eventually brings him to Simferopol's central square. To the right of the square is the presidential palace, a large but elegant 4-story building looking like a baby hermitage with its pale green paint and white trim. Thomas sees the Crimean flag flying above the building, a wide central field of white pearl bordered above with a thin red stripe and below with blue. On a flagpole next to it is the Simferopol city flag, a white star on a red background surrounded by 5 stylized golden honeybees. It's the first time he's seen either flag with his own eyes, and he feels a momentary adrenaline buzz at the strangeness of it, his old wanderlust returning. To the left of the square is a huge opera house built with glass and austere gray concrete slabs. Thomas is the only person he knows who actually enjoys the Soviet brutalist architectural style, though he is sensitive enough to understand that he may like it only because he doesn't have to live surrounded by it. In the center of the square, on a 3-meter-tall plinth, is the city's traditional grand bronze statue of Lenin. During his early travels in the former Soviet states, Thomas had once been surprised at how often he encountered statues and paintings of good old Vladimir Ilyich. But now he finds it amusing and, if anything, reassuring that the locals are embracing their history for better or worse, rather than denying it or trying to rewrite it. Thomas nods at the statue as he passes, not so much in courtesy to Vladimir Ilyich as in a more general reverence for the past. Thomas follows Prospect Kirova past the roundabout of Plashad Sovietskaya, Council Square, and takes a right. After a brisk walk, he finds himself in a neglected semi-industrial zone. By now, he's almost a half hour late for the interview, and a bit disgusted with himself, because he started his walking tour by turning the wrong way up Ulitsa Gogolya while trying to get to the center, and didn't realize he had to double back until he was deep into another empty, rusting industrial zone. He thought his days of getting lost in foreign cities were over. His mistake wasn't due to a lack of attention. Antonis hadn't mentioned that the factory was a cold water flat, and Thomas's morning shower had been a masochistic 5-minute exercise under a freezing tap. At least his mind feels invigorated and cruelly sharp now. Thomas checks his notebook again to confirm the address. The building he stands before looks more residential than business, not the sort of place he would expect to find a foreign development bank office. The building's bricks are charcoaled with a century of engine exhaust from the street. The front door is nested in an ornate wrought iron and colored glass grillwork, bent into a Gothic tangle. A stylized cursive inscription engraved into the grill under a leering gargoyle face reads, "Mundus vult decipi, ergo decipiare." Thomas presses a button labeled 3 on a brass panel next to the door. And after a moment, a loud, grinding electric buzz releases the lock for him. He pushes the heavy door open and enters the stairwell. The door's pneumatics close with an uncomfortably loud and final metallic crash behind him. On the 3rd floor, he finds a door labeled European Investment Bank, Crimea Satellite Office, in English and Cyrillic. He pushes the door open and says, "Hey, sorry I'm late. I had a problem with the, directions." He freezes mid-stride, the door halfway open. No one's home, looks like. The office is an unremarkable white room, work desk and chairs, coffee table with magazines, a potted hyacinth in the window, and an incongruously placed life-size poster of an attractive woman wearing a fitted dark gray suit hanging on one wall. The poster isn't a poster. Thomas is startled when the woman moves, just after the half-second Thomas takes to size up the room. She'd been standing very still by the wall, and his senses must still be a little slow from the night before. "Mr. Kozak," smiles the woman. She walks forward and extends a hand. Sorry I'm late," he says again. He is surprised by the firmness of her handshake. "Do not worry," she says crisply with an accent that is Eastern European but not quite Slavic. "Monsieur Lafal has had a problem with his car and will be late. I am Lina Mara Virtanen, second secretary for the EIB Special Projects Mission in Crimea, and I can brief you on the situation here, if that is acceptable to you." "Yes, of course it is." He tries to sound crisp and professional himself, and now wishes he wore something besides the standard journalist cliché outfit of work slacks, tan shirt, and multi-pocket ripstop vest under a weathered black Royal Navy seaman's jacket. Lena is slender and looks very young, with a wide mouth and high cheekbones. Her orange hair is pulled back into a bun, speared through with two long yellow lead pencils, the way Thomas remembers that Japanese girls in San Francisco sometimes use chopsticks to fashion their hair. He likes the way she wears the high collar of her white shirt outside the lapels of her suit. "Would you like some tea?" she asks. "Yes, I think some tea would be lovely." Thomas wonders why he feels the urge to speak formally now. "Please, be comfortable, and I'll come back in a moment." Thomas removes his jacket and tries to be comfortable, whatever that is. He lifts a recent copy of The Economist from the coffee table and sees beneath it two blue and gold-bound European Union studies on the energy and telecom sectors in Crimea. The studies are about 6 months old, and he's read both of them already. Not enough energy, not enough telecom. So he pages through The Economist. The magazine's cover depicts an American stealth bomber suspended in an ominous orange sky, with the headline, "Next Stop, Iran." Great, more good news. He doesn't follow Iran. His interest stretches to the Caspian Sea, but not the Persian Gulf. Flipping pages, he stops to read a story titled, "Red Point Finance Chief Resigns in Reserves Crisis." This should be good, Thomas chuckles. He's never interviewed the leadership of Red Point Energy, but knows them by reputation. Red Point was smaller than the other super majors like ExxonMobil, British Petroleum, or Chevron, but made up for its size with hyper-aggressive marketing and acquisition strategies. Thomas has heard people hurl terrible and often unfair accusations against the oil industry, but those accusations tended to be more true of Red Point than the other companies. Now, according to The Economist, Red Point had been caught overstating their petroleum reserves by almost a third, inflating the company's stock value. Thomas is not surprised by the story and is only disappointed that he wasn't the one to break the news. He never much cared for the people at Red Point. He stands again as Lena re-enters the room. She hands him a blue folder printed with the circled gold stars of the European Union and places a gold-rimmed teacup and saucer on the desk in front of Thomas's chair. "Here is some information about our mission. Now, I expect you will want me to tell you what we're doing here in Crimea," she says. She stares at him in what looks like surprise for a moment, but Thomas realizes that her eyes just work that way. They seem too large, and they're an unexpectedly deep shade of blue. "Actually, Lena, I would like to get a broader view of what's happening in the country as a whole, but the energy market seems like a good place to start because Crimea is really in trouble, isn't it?" "Well," she sits on the side of the desk about a meter away from Thomas, then smooths out her skirt and stares at him, porcelain still. From her eyes, though, he can tell that she is thinking. "I am not permitted to go on public record, so you mustn't quote me. When you talk to Mansour Lafal, he can confirm what I've said." "That's fair enough." "What you say is true. Crimea is in trouble. All of the Ukraine's major power plants were on Ukrainian territory when Crimea split off in 1991. There is an object called TES, an old gas-fired heat power station outside Simferopol, but it doesn't provide nearly enough electricity to meet demand." "So where does the power come from, then?" "Crimea used to buy electricity from the Ukrainian grid and transfer it over on power lines. But since the Ukrainians finally shut Chernobyl down, they haven't had any excess capacity that they can sell abroad, even with the K2 R4 reactors that came online in 2005. And with the present political difficulties between Crimea and Ukraine, she cants her head a millimeter, maybe two. The Ukrainians have been less willing to sell power here. So now Crimea has to buy power mostly from Russia through a complicated set of agreements with Ukraine. Russia has its own problems too, and the price they charge for power is burying the Crimean economy. What is the Crimean government doing about it? Basically, running themselves bankrupt. Crim Energo, the Crimean energy monopoly, would need to triple the retail cost of electricity in order to pay the Russians, but the economy would collapse if they passed that cost on to customers. So the government subsidizes Crim Energo to keep the company more or less functioning, and forces them to charge artificially low prices. The Crimean energy market is incredibly inefficient as well. The infrastructure has not been maintained and is falling apart from age. In the winter, the grid doesn't have the capacity to meet demand, so Crim Energo has to depower non-essential services. They create rolling blackouts across the country. And it's getting worse. The economy is so bad that people have resorted to stealing power lines and equipment from the grid so they can sell it as metal scrap. That results in even more blackouts. Today, energy use, GDP, and living standards are even less than half of what they were in 1991. "So that's why you're here, right?" Thomas says. "The EIB is buying Crimea a new power plant." "Well, not quite. We have loaned them 110 million euros, which will be about two-thirds of the construction and ramp-up costs for the power station. The other third will come from the Crimean government and Crim Energo. They're rebuilding an old ruin in Nikolaevka on the west coast of Crimea north of Sevastopol. In the 1980s, the Soviets began a nuclear power station there, and we encouraged Crim Energo to use the partially completed object at Nikolaevka 1 as the foundation for the new power station." "Will it be a nuclear-powered station?" "Of course not. It will be natural gas-powered. Even so, we think that about half of the construction materials from the old station can be reused. Fortunately, the original Soviet engineers did not reach the stage of construction in which they would have begun using special amalgamations in the design." "You mean no radioactive material," he says. "No radioactive or extremely toxic amalgamations, no. They had not yet completed the reactor chamber." "So, is there a lot of natural gas in Crimea?" "Not much, but the Crimeans can import the gas. It's basically the same deal the European Union offered Estonia a few years ago. The Estonians used to be almost self-sufficient for electricity, but we were using oil shale as fuel, which was a disaster for the environment. So we were persuaded to increase our gas consumption." Thomas notes the statement, then thinks about Lena's name, and makes the connection. "You're Estonian." Lena smiles. "Yes, I am. I was working for Eesti Välisministeerium before I was loaned out to the EIB. So do you work in Brussels or Tallinn when you're not on foreign missions?" "Why are you asking personal questions, Thomas?" he thinks to himself. "This isn't relevant, you dumbass." "I lived in Brussels while they were training me for the EIB mission, but I'm floating at the moment. Right now my only address is here in Simferopol." She continues to smile faintly. "Okay, Thomas looks through his notes for a moment, buying time to get his mind back on the story. A phone on the desk rings harshly. Startled by the racket, Thomas notices that the phone is pleasingly old tech, huge and gunmetal gray, with a yellowed plastic circular dial on the front. Lena pulls the boxy metal receiver to her ear. The size of the receiver makes her face seem small and even younger in contrast. "EIB?" She listens for a moment, then responds with a sentence in French. After another moment, she looks at Thomas and raises one pale orange eyebrow. "Ah, it is for you." Thomas takes the phone from Lena, feeling silly. Across the wire flows a voice with a thick but pleasant French accent. "Mr. Kozak, this is Sylvain Lafalle, head of mission here. I'm sorry, but I won't be able to come to the office today. Can you meet me another time?" "Yeah, of course. I've gotten a briefing on your mission from Ms. Virtanen, he says, enjoying how Lena raises one corner of her mouth very slightly when he mentions her name. Can I get a look at the construction site of the power station at Nikolaevka? I'd like to take some photos for my story. Nikolaevka 1, yes, we can manage that, says LaFall. Though there's not much to see right now. There's a Krim Energo survey team working the site. Can you meet me on Thursday at 15? I have a visit scheduled for that afternoon anyway. Let me take a look. Thomas opens the cover of his datebook and pulls up the schedule, which he knows to be blank. Thursday at 15, sure, I'll meet you there. He scribbles the appointment into the book. Thomas hands the phone back to Lena. LaFall will take me to Nikolaevka so I can look around, so I, guess I won't trouble you anymore. Oh, it's no trouble, says Lena quickly. Yes, well, I should, Thomas stands and smiles at Lena awkwardly. Yes, Lena stands as well and self-consciously smooths her skirt. I should go. I have a meeting. Thomas lies, gesturing at his watch without looking at it. Yes, of course. She brushes an imaginary strand of hair out of her face, then abruptly launches a hand out toward Thomas. Goodbye, she says too formally, as he returns her firm handshake. Yes, goodbye. Thomas turns and walks stiffly to the door. He looks back once as he walks away, to see Lena standing absolutely still, watching him leave. It's not till later, when Thomas sits down in a bus heading back toward the factory, that the awkwardness wears off, and he has to smile, surprised at his own behavior. What the hell was that about? Flush with a sudden wave of optimism, Thomas decides to be spontaneous and gets off the bus a few stops early. He strolls down Prospect Kirova back toward the center, taking a right on Ulitsa Karla Marxa, a stone-paved vehicle-free zone. He checks out the other people as they scuttle up and down the pedestrian street and window gazes the few shops. It's cold and damp, but Thomas doesn't mind right now. The architecture, what he can see of it through the fog, makes Simferopol seem a younger sister to St. Petersburg rather than Moscow. He passes a lot of classical stone as it peeks out between anonymous, horrendously ugly concrete apartment blocks, and in the more residential areas, ramshackle single-story houses. Most of his time in Russia has been in the big cities, so he has little experience for comparison. He begins to feel a welcome prickle of strangeness and distance, the stranger in a strange land feeling, the sharpening perception of sounds around him, the sound of his footsteps on damp concrete, a motorcycle engine starting on the next street, a girl's voice singing a pop song faintly from an open window somewhere, and then it's upon him, the awareness, the tingle in the back of his neck, and a feeling of waking suddenly. He breathes out slowly, lengthens his stride, relaxes his shoulders. Be here now. Be only here now, he whispers to himself and smiles. This awareness is what he came here for. Thomas continues down Karla Marxa, people watching, discreetly checking out the babushkas bundled against the cold and the skinny leather jacket-clad locals. Everyone is dressed in black or gray, and they move quickly, hands in pockets, hunched against the weather and the hard stone of the building fronts. The clothes they wear and the items in the stores are refreshingly free from obvious marketing influence. The clothes and goods are simply designed to survive the environment. This is what Thomas likes about frontiers. It's the austere beauty and the adversity that turns him on. People are stretched thin with poverty and sleeplessness, but there's an authenticity to life in places like this that he misses when he's in London or San Francisco. When he had been in St. Petersburg the weeks before, he could already tell the city was beginning to lose its charm for him. He found too many new cars on the pitted streets, and too much brand-name clothing on the people, the well-off ones at least. All it would take is one fucking Hilfiger store, he jokes to himself morosely, and I'll never be able to set foot in that town again. Of course, he reminds himself that he can afford to feel romantic about austerity. He's got a flat in London he can go back to. The East End flat he shares with his friend Omar, a financial journalist working with the Herald Tribune, is tiny, unpleasant smelling, It's above a kebab shop, and wildly overpriced. But most of the people on the street around him here in Simferopol would probably sell a kidney to switch places with him. It's the same ambiguity that he always feels when he tries to go native someplace low-tech. Thomas feels a responsibility to keep in mind that he's swooping into town with the equivalent of half a year's average local wages. He's going to pound out a story here, live well for a few weeks, and then disappear westward again. He has no right to feel romantic about Simferopol, or half the places he's been, precisely because he's not native, merely naive. That argument makes sense in his head, if only he could keep his heart out of it. Something grabs Thomas's attention from the corner of his eye as he walks former down the street, then arrests him mid-stride as he recognizes what calls to him. He stands in front of a used typewriter store on the corner of Karla Marxa and Zhukovskaya. The shop is closed, but the hulks of six or seven monstrous steel machines are on display in the window, their keys showing Cyrillic letters in black on steel worn down by decades of use, or on the faded cream color of decomposing synthetic ivory. Each of the typewriter's giant cast-iron shells looks too heavy for one person to lift, all except for one much smaller model in the corner of the display. Thomas angles himself so he can get a better look through the smudged window. The smaller, almost feminine machine gleams dully in the gray afternoon light. The words Katalin Turov, Grozny, are printed in delicate sans serifs on the case, and Thomas sees that it still has the two archaic Cyrillic letters Yat and E that were eliminated from the Russian language after the revolution. He makes a mental note of the shop's address, takes a left, and continues walking. He passes an outdoor market another two blocks down as he heads back toward the factory. At the edge of the market, a choir of four gray pensioners in worn-out Soviet Navy uniforms chant an old song about disasters at sea and girls they'll never meet again. As Thomas passes, he throws a couple of thick brass 100-ruble coins into their upturned officer's hat. To thank him for his generosity, wise guy nature decides to soak him in a nearly freezing downpour a few minutes later. Nice. To dodge the weather, Thomas runs into a kiosk on Gogolia and buys a Russian-language newspaper, a carton of Primas, two bottles of Crimean Muscat wine, eggs, chicken broth in a can, a quarter kilo of pork, a fistful of leeks, a bag of rice and a liter carton of some kind of yogurt drink called Vla. When he returns to the factory, he peels out of his wet jacket, puts the groceries away, lights a Prima, and boots his power book. As he begins typing his notes from the meeting with Lena, he hears a girl's voice coming from the PC that had been beeping the night before. Now, faintly reciting strings of numbers in five-digit groups against a background of hissing radio static. Dva, pyat, devyat, shest, vosim. Tri, siem, adin, chetirya, pyat. Vosim, adin, dva, shest, adin. Pyat, pyat, vosim, adin, devyat. He stares at the screen but can't make sense of whatever software the PC is running, so he just lets it run. At first, Thomas thinks the noise is distracting, but after a while he decides he likes it. He finds the volume knob on the computer's speakers and turns it up. Thomas closes and packs away the power book when he's finished with it, then pokes around the bookshelf in the other room till he finds a phone directory for Simferopol. When he opens it, he sees the pages look old and yellowed. He checks the date on the front cover and reads 1993. Ah, give me a break, he says to himself, but takes the book into the workroom where the phone is. He sits and pages through the book until he finds the entry for Krim Enigo. He dials the six-digit number and lets it ring while he stares at the monitor of the talking PC again, trying to puzzle out what it's actually supposed to be doing. There is a single dialogue box, which reads, Priniyat, 16186-G16, and below that, Povtorit, 15992-M4. Receive and repeat, Thomas says to himself, mystified. After about 30 rings, a brusque male voice finally answers on the phone. Zdravstvuyte, begins Thomas, and continues in his best Russian. I'm a journalist who is interested in the operations of Crim Enigo, and I would like to speak to your public relations officer. What? Says the man on the other end of the phone, and rattles off a burst of Russian too quick for Thomas to catch. Hello, is it possible to speak to your public relations officer? I am... Thomas replies more slowly, and, he hopes, clearly, but halfway through, he hears what sounds like the other guy cursing, and then a sharp click. Hey, same to you! Thomas yells into the dead phone, then slams it down and pouts. He pulls on the Prima and listens to the serene voice of the numbers girl to try to calm down. He reaches over to the second PC, interrupting its anime screensaver. When he pulls up a browser and connects to the internet, the high-pitched squeal from the PC's modem makes him smile. A broadband boy, he forgot what a dial-up system sounds like. Connection seems to take forever. When the machine finally links in, Thomas pulls up a search engine and looks for Crim Enigo. He's surprised to find that a site actually exists for the company. The site is little more than a single page in Ukrainian, listing the company's address and number. He compares the number with the one in the phone book and finds them to be identical. He dials the number again and waits while it rings for a few long minutes before it disconnects with a click. Failure, Thomas says to himself. He gives up on the computer and struggles through the lead story in the newspaper instead. Antonis had been right. The square, fleshy face of President Chernyarukov is plastered in black and white all over the front page, one finger raised in righteous accusation. On the left margin are insets with small photographs of the four martyred soldiers. None of them look over 20 years old. Chernyarukov's speech, printed word for word, could be part of a script from a bad American movie, with lots of references to the authority of the state. Thomas's favorite bit is where the president calls on all Crimeans to join together and fight the terrorist Shak Ali. He scans the other headlines throughout the rest of the paper and finds them to follow the same repetitively nationalistic theme. Thomas leaves the newspaper on the table and reaches for the folder Lena gave him at the EIB office. He pages through the contents, mostly just to feel as if he's doing something productive. The European Investment Bank is the investment banking arm of the European Union and the world's leading public financial institution in terms of annual loan volumes. The bank helps governments from Eastern Europe to Central Asia finance public works projects and pave the way for stable, prosperous futures. The EIB's mandate requires that loans be disbursed only within countries that show positive movement towards democracy, market economics, and respects for human rights and the environment. Positive movement toward democracy. Thomas compares the phrase to what he's heard about the Crimean government so far and can't make sense of the dissonance. He's interrupted by the sound of the front door opening. It's Antonis and a shortish, slightly overweight man in his 30s with a tangle of wiry black hair. Both of them are wet from the weather. The black-haired guy is carrying a cardboard box full of club brochures, which he drops on the table next to the computers. He removes his thick, steel-rimmed glasses and wipes the mist off them with a handkerchief, then replaces them and looks at Thomas with a puzzled expression. "Hello, Thomas," Antonis says, hanging up his coat. "You should meet Savely. He works here, too. He's the mastermind behind all of this." Antonis waves vaguely to the factory and everything in it. Savely pulls off his wet raincoat, revealing a threadbare dark gray sweater and faded brown corduroys. He sends a tentative hand toward Thomas. "You're a writer?" he asks. Thomas shrugs. "I'm a journalist." "Who are you writing for?" Savely, suspicious. "The Invisible Hand, it's one of the big six. But I'm just a freelancer, I'm not staff." "Uh-huh. You want to write about politics in Crimea?" "Yeah, energy policy, which is half business and half politics, usually." Savely turns to Antonis and launches a quick burst of Russian. Thomas can tell it means, roughly translated, "Who the hell is this guy?" "He's cool," says Antonis hopefully. "I met him through the Transitions Online message board. We've been talking for about a year. I've read his stuff. He used to work for Neon Helix." Savely knits his brow and looks sourly at Thomas, then back to Antonis, then back to Thomas again. "You worked for Neon Helix?" Thomas is surprised. Actually, I was there when St. Lucie and the Marshals started it all.
In California?
Savali asks.
Yeah.
Thomas doesn't know whether to laugh or feel embarrassed. He's closed off that time of his life. He hadn't expected to still find disciples of Neon, especially not here.
What are you...
Savali seems mystified at this and searches for words.
So what the hell are you doing writing for a business magazine?
He says the word business as if it's an obscenity. Thomas laughs.
I need the money.
Savali smiles at him, still a little skeptical. Neon Helix. He shakes his head. You know, 10 years ago, Neon Helix and that whole San Francisco scene was a blueprint of what I wanted to try to create here in Crimea. Thomas nods and smiles. He can see all the signs now. The obsolete electronics should have been the early telltale.
Okay, Savali, you lost me, says Antonis. I remember you told me Neon Helix was some kind of American hacker thing, but I didn't know you cared so much about it. I'm hurt. You've been keeping secrets from me.
Thomas opens his mouth to explain, but Savali cuts him off, almost giddy.
Neon Helix was a group of theorists and technologists and artists who came together in California in the early 1990s and wanted to accelerate the evolution of the human species.
Well, Thomas scratches the back of his head, you make that all sound very noble, but mostly it was just a prank that got out of hand.
I still have no idea what you guys are talking about, Antonis frowns.
Thomas closes his eyes for a moment, realizing he has no way to escape now. So he smiles crookedly and begins to tell them the story.